Amid the agonies of the news cycle, there was a fantastically good piece of news this week. Someone's basement, I believe it was, I think a sister-in-law's basement, they found a John Coltrane quartet recording from 1963. Not a posthumous recording, not an archived recording, something that no one had ever heard before. That's just me sharing the good word. I don't know if it connects to the sermon, but I'm going to try to connect it because it's such good news, and we all need good news. What I want to talk to you about is what some might call the difference between a truth and the truth. And the challenge of differentiating between the relative and the objective. And I guess where I will go, I'll reveal my premise beforehand. I think both exist in our world. I think there are truly a lot of relative experiences and a few clear objective experiences. Many things, if not most, have relative experience, but there are objective experiences. And so within that matrix, how do we know? How do we know when it's right to stake a moral claim, an absolute claim, that we have some vision of an absolute truth, and how can our moral compass be attuned to true magnetic north? It's a big challenge presented by this week's parasha. We see a lot of relativity and condemnation, effectively. The scouts, the spies, whichever word you want to use to translate, become known for being relativists, moral relativists, and that's the condemnation that God and Moses plague them with. On the other hand, to many sets of eyes and many perceptions, their words are true. So here's a few things, I think, that we struggle with when we can't or struggle to find or acknowledge, even, a relative truth. So the scouts, I like to call them scouts. I think that was their job. The two fellows in the Haftarah are definitely spies. To start off with the relative truth that I just thought of, Rahav to her people is a betrayer. She's a Benedict Arnold to her people, but treason. But to us, she's part of the heroic story of Joshua. So the spies report that the people, the descendants of the giants, live in the land of Canaan. But we know, at least within the context of Scripture, this to be true. Genesis 6 talks about the creation of demigods and the giant folk. And we know Sihon and Og to be giant kings. I think even reflected in the selection of Saul, Shaul, as a tall king. The people of the land must have been out of the ordinary tall. And you do have tribal differences in height in various places of the world. But I think what Rabbeinu Hananel, one of the mostly known for his commentary on Talmud, but he does have some Torah commentary, suggests is not that they were seeing what was currently there. They didn't do an accurate survey, but they knew the stories. They knew what had been there, and they fit their data into their perception of history, which we do all the time. In the seeking of truth, we put data that fits into our preconceived ideas into the category of higher volume, higher importance, and data that challenges our preconceptions into lesser important categories. I think that's one of the things that causes us to stumble when we seek to ascertain truth, ethical verities, when we seek to orient ourselves toward the absolute, toward faith, and toward the moral compass. But there are so many ways of viewing things. I can pronounce an S much better than Elchanan. I am significantly taller than him and have much greater carrying capacity. I do not have the height of Andre the Giant nor the carrying capacity of Arnold Schwarzenegger. We exist in a matrix of bell curves and spectra. And so we're even told about the people of the land, albeit that they were tall and strong, not, of course, as strong as Rick. And the land was one that devoured its inhabitants. We refer to it as Eretz Ochelet Yosheveha. That's not actually a compliment to the land. And the people living there being strong is not a compliment to the land. All we're saying is that in regards to a difficult countryside that produced produce only at the sweat of the brow, these people had good constitution to live there. There are no absolutes in that description. Relative to the land, these people were strong, because for a puny and weak people, maybe morally, maybe agriculturally, maybe in terms of combat, the land would have swallowed them up. Ordinary people would die there, says Sforno, because the climate is so hard to take. And then I think we do this thing within ourselves that I think is a great source of relativity and a valid source of relativity. I often say that for teens and those younger, that being of two minds, being ambiguous, is a kind of hypocrisy. But believing A and not A as an adult is just adulthood. That a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. Not everything fits into neat categories, and sometimes we have to do what Orwell called doublethink. I mean, I really think that is a hallmark of adulthood, is the ability to think almost in quantum categories of wave and particle, of A and not A, of present and not present. That not all things are exclusive of each other. And one of the things suggested of Kalev is that he had two spirits, that he was mutable for good and for ill. He had a different spirit than the other scouts, that he was capable of existing across the fence in both the positive and negative sense. What's interesting etymologically about his name, what does his name sound like for those of you who speak modern Hebrew? Kalev? Kalev, the dog. Implication being he had fealty to his master. Likely a good thing, he had fealty to God. But it's not the nicest name you could give a child. I mean, I know people who have given that to a child, but it comes with a tension. And we look at our people being named Yisrael and Yaakov, those who wrestle, those who struggle with God. And a tension inherent in the name Islam, not to deface or defame another religion, but Islam means to submit. I mean, at least by title, we are very different religions. By practice, we have a lot in common. And Talmud notes this, that Kalev was mutable. He was not ab initio. He was not from the beginning certain that the land must be settled. He changed his mind, whereas Joshua didn't. Again, I want to stress, I think there is value to relative existence, relative understanding, and value to absolute certainty. And the question is, and I don't know that I'll answer this for you, the question is, when do you believe one and when do you believe the other? When do you admit alternate explanations, alternate opinions, and when do you think or clarify to yourself that you have the truth, not just a truth? What was said to me by a rabbi during my master's program was, do you think Torah is a book or the book? And I don't think there's an obvious answer. To me, that's not an obvious answer, because I think Shakespeare has a lot of deep spiritual wisdom, as does E.E. Cummings. But there is something, there is a more profound truth. And perhaps what makes it, in effect, a relative truth is that real profound truth, real deep and true faith, eludes words. That when we use the word God, that when we use the word prophet, that when we use the word holy, we are already committing a kind of idolatry. That we are already turning something that is ineffable into letters. That's the reason, partly the reason, you should never write G-D. It's not God's name. It's a false capturing of God's essence, and frankly, just God's job title. Putting God in letters, except for the four-letter name and the word El, is not something we value as much. These are just descriptors of things that can't be described. So faith, as Paul Tillich would say is really about striving and trying to approach absolute truth, is striving for things beyond. And I think the relics of our Torah and Talmud are sacred, not necessarily, we're talking about a double think on this one, not necessarily because I believe God wrote them, but because they are records of people striving towards something beyond themselves. And that alone merits our attention, presence, and awe. This was not about people trying to aggrandize themselves. It was about people trying to understand deeper truth. And recognizing, I think, in their world, as we talk about Rachav, as we talk about the scouts, that things can exist from multiple angles, that the Torah itself is a prism, an aspaklaria, a speculum that shines and reveals many different aspects to us. But there is something it is all pointing at. Now, if you ascend a mountain, if you're in the park, Smokies, and you're going up, I would imagine in several places there are several different routes, but they all aim at the peak. That's, to me, the nature of religious life. Or, to use another metaphor, that Charles Fells, a pastor in North Knoxville, used, they're all lights from the same building. You're outside the building, and you see the light within, but you're just looking at one window. But we have to be assured that something exists, that there is deeper meaning. Even if, I really do believe there is an absolute truth, but in many cases, except maybe the case of racism being inexcusable, or that the climate is surely changing because of man-made interference. There are truths and inescapable scientific facts, but in so many cases, we are just striving at a truth that can't be named. So I want to share with you two thoughts that our sages had about this parsha. The people who were cursed not to enter the land, again, they count from 20 and below and 20 and above. And the sense is, if you've gotten to 20 and you don't get God, you never will. I don't agree with, but I think there is some sort of unspeakable, ineffable process to faith. It's sort of, you get it or you don't. It's caught and not taught. And the other thing that the Netziv says, I believe that's Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin of the 19th century, this I love. This, I think, captures it really well. The scouts relate a truth. They were right. The people were big. The grapes were huge. It's dangerous. Their cities are fortified. But the land has another hidden truth. I think this is saying there is a more absolute foundational truth. The land has another hidden truth that there is an unbreakable bond between the people Israel and its land. I'm not going in a political direction with that today of all days. I'm just saying that there are deeper truths. And there are deeper truths that don't have an objective reality or an ontological reality. They're hard to grasp. They are shady and ambiguous and even ambivalent. But they exist, and we just spend our lives looking for them. You know, as the natural law theorists of the 17th and 18th century would say, there is a deeper place that we can at least try to ascertain. They believed you could ascertain it, but I believe the process of looking is real. So with that in mind, I wasn't going to be able to offer you a one-and-done answer, a take-home bullet point, because it's not a real clear dividing line between the relative and the absolute. It's more of a sense of perspective. So with that in mind, I think about this. And this plays out, according to Rashbam, who is one of Rashi's grandchildren, in the question of the spies feeling like, the scouts feeling like grasshoppers relative to the giants of the land. This I think about a lot. You might be really talented in music or medicine, and your neighbor might be less talented in music or medicine or along one parameter, or you might be taller or shorter or better, more athletic, and if you think about it, there's a distance between you. You could even express it as a height category, as a chart category, but the problem is you may be here and your friend may be here, but God's so far away, God doesn't see the difference. That's what Rashbam says about the idea of people feeling as grasshoppers. The one who is enthroned in the vault of the earth, from Isaiah he quotes, views all inhabitants as grasshoppers. Which is not to make you feel bad, it's to make you feel comforted in the way that looking at the ocean makes you feel small. There is an absolute truth. We won't grasp it. It is as far above us as the sun and stars, and we are in some ways irrelevant to the absolute truth, which is not to say we don't look towards it. We always look up at the moon and sun. But in some places, those relatives become fold into an absolute. Schrodinger's cat. It's a place where the quantum folds into the Newtonian. So I want to leave you with this, because this is a central mitzvah of the parsha, tzitzit. Right? Tzitzit, the last paragraph we read in the sections of the Shema. That paragraph is in this week's parsha. Tzitzit remind us, in part, that there are mitzvot, but also through that reminder that there is something eternal, and there are eternal verities beyond us. And like tying a string around your finger or putting a kippah on your head, they remind you that there is something above and beyond you. And so, truly, there are relative truths. Oh, I came back to it. My relative truth is that John Coltrane was the greatest artist of the 20th century. To me, it's an absolute truth, but I do recognize that at a level, it is a relative truth. But to God, we are all valuable. And when we look at our tzitzit, and when we think of the Lord above, the Almighty above, we should recognize that our relative truths should not be held so tightly that we lose sight of what's beyond.